Hello and welcome to Home to Her, the podcast that's dedicated to reclaiming the lost and stolen wisdom of the sacred feminine. I'm your host, Liz Kelly, and on each episode, we explore her stories and myths, her spiritual principles, and most importantly, what this wisdom has to offer us right now. Thanks for being here. Let's get started. Hey, everybody, before we dive into this next episode, I wanted to pop on here and give a little plug for my next upcoming course through the Home to Her Academy. It's called Returning to the Well, Sacred Wisdom for the Motherhood Journey. And I'm teaching this in partnership with the wonderful and amazing Elizabeth Gould, who is a past podcast guest and also a mother, writer, teacher, and menstrual activist, and the former director of a nonprofit dedicated to positive menstrual and menopausal education and awareness. We have been collaborating and dreaming this up for many months now. And this is a 5-week online course that explores the divine journey of motherhood and what it means to parent in partnership with the sacred feminine. It begins Sunday, October 29th. Classes are at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. They're live and will be recorded if you are not able to join in person. And as always, all the classes through Home to Her Academy are designed to be interactive and engaging. So for this one, we will include the historical perspectives on motherhood, goddesses and archetypes that teach us about divine mothering, discussion around what it means to weave the sacred into our everyday parenting practices and activities, creative writing exercises, movement, meditation, and more. And we are offering this at this time of year for a very specific reason. If you're listening to this when it's released, you know that we're headed into the end of the year, which can get very, very hectic with the holidays for a lot of us. So we want to explore together what it means to bring more intention, more care, and more self-care to these times, which will benefit not only our children, but ourselves. So check it out. Classes are offered live on Zoom. Starts October 29th on a Sunday. You can learn more and register at hometoheracademy.com, and you can find all of this in the show notes. And that's it. Hope you enjoy today's show. Hello, hello, everybody, and welcome to the show. This is Liz joining you as usual from the unceded ancestral lands of the Monacan Nation in Central Virginia, and I am so glad that you are here with me today. And as always, if you are interested in finding out whose native lands that you're residing on, you don't know, go to native-land.ca. There's a fantastic map of pretty much the entire world. So if you're residing on Indigenous land somewhere, you can find out whose. I also want to recommend checking out the Coalition of Natives and Allies. This is a small group of Indigenous women and their white allies, and they offer a lot of educational resources on their website. I'll put this in the show notes so you can find it. They've also recently produced a short film that I had the privilege of seeing, which is really wonderful, and they're accepting applications for showing it in small group educational settings. So I'm going to put that in the show notes so you can learn more too. But it's a really great group that was founded. One of the co-founders is one of my past podcast guests, Arla Patch, and who's also the fabulous cover artist for my book. So some really good stuff there. And are you interested in learning about the sacred feminine in a deeper way? If so, then I would love for you to check out the online school that I launched very recently, Home to Her Academy. My vision for the school is to bring together qualified, really engaging instructors who can teach us about the sacred feminine in ways that are, first of all, rooted in the historical record, but are also embodied and intuitive, so inviting us to know with more than our minds, like a both and situation. I don't think we have to choose between those things. I also want to teach this in a way that's intersectional, so really addressing head on these messy entanglements of spirituality, patriarchy, misogyny, racism, colonialism, et cetera. It's all kind of intertwined together, and so the intent is to talk about those things together. And then finally, you know, sharing this information in a way that's practical. So it's meaning that you can really apply this to your real, ordinary, complicated, messy life. So check out hometoheracademy.com to see what's going on and what's coming up. You can sign up for my newsletter there. So if you want to be notified of other classes that are rolling out, I've been working really hard behind the scenes, just having amazing conversations with people who are going to join me to teach future classes. So just keep checking back because more is going to be coming. And if you would rather read about the sacred feminine, then maybe you want to check out my book, Home to Her, Walking the Transformative Path of the Sacred Feminine from Womancraft Publishing. It is a 2023 Nautilus Gold Award recipient. Woohoo! And it's available wherever you buy your books. But please do consider buying it from Womancraft, which is an amazing woman-owned business. You can order it directly from them or order it from your local bookstore. Give your local community a little bit of love. And I will put the Womancraft link in the website too. Last thing I'm going to say is if you've read the book, your reviews are so helpful for other people finding this information. Reviews on Amazon and Goodreads in particular really help. And the same goes with this podcast. If you like this show, I would love to have your favorable reviews. Reviews on Apple iTunes are super helpful, but I will take them anywhere. And if you have reflections and feedback and any information that you want to share, I really do love it when you reach out. So feel free to contact me via social media channels. Instagram is particularly good, but I'll put that all in the show notes too. All right. That's all my plugs. Let's get on with why we're here, shall we? All right. So let's talk about my guest today. There are so many people exploring what I call the sacred feminine, what I call it, you know, in unique ways. And one of the ways that I personally find super interesting is when we return to some of the old stories that so many of us know, or we think we know really well, maybe even stories that we've cast aside because we're like, well, this is a bunch of hoo-ha. It doesn't tell me much of anything here. When women start to re-examine them and they start to ask some really important questions in the process, like, well, who got to tell that story? And what was the context? And what were they trying to convey? And is this the only way this can be interpreted? So I think my guest today is doing some really beautiful work on this front. I can't wait to have her tell us all about it. So let me introduce her to you now. Rhonna Dietrich left the church and religion nearly 20 years ago, but took the stories of women with her. Her career has included human resources training and executive leadership. But these days, she is a spiritual director, coach, speaker, and writer. She gave a provocative TED talk on an Eve who inspires and empowers women instead of shaming and silencing them. And she is the author of the new book, Rewriting Eve, Rescuing Women's Stories from the Bible and Reclaiming Them as Our Own. After living most of her life in the Pacific Northwest, she is now just minutes from the Atlantic Ocean in Hampstead, North Carolina, where she continues to write, drink strong coffee, have beautiful conversations with her clients, and cannot be dissuaded from the belief that her two daughters are the most amazing humans on the planet. I don't know, Rhonna. I think my kids are the most amazing humans on the planet, too. We could battle about that later. And she's joining us from her home there today. Rhonna, thank you so much for being here. It's a gift and an honor to have your presence.
My privilege and pleasure, Liz. Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm. Well, y'all know if you've listened, and Rhonna, you know, if you've heard the show at all, that I usually like to start with people's spiritual background because I'm curious and I like to hear like what's worth keeping and you know, what maybe you toss aside on the way. And this also feels very relevant to your work in particular. So I'd love to hear you talk about, you know, where you started and how that journey kind of unfolded for you.
Sure. I grew up in a pretty traditional Christian home and context, Protestant, mostly Presbyterian, went to church every Sunday, went to Sunday school, went to vacation Bible school, went to a Christian college, later married a pastor who I ultimately divorced, but like everything was seeped in that language, those stories, that world. And I think until I was probably 40. I didn't even think anything of it. Like it's the water that I swam in. It's the world that I knew. I didn't have any sense of needing to reject it. I didn't really question it. And in fact, I was pretty committed and driven, not always in the best of ways, to have more faith, to believe better, to be more faithful, to kind of climb the ladder in a spiritual sort of way in terms of being stronger, better, you know, all of those things. And I can tell the story of how that all began to fall apart or what prompted that. But in terms of my origin and more of my life than not, it has been all that I've known and at times even appreciated, respected, and loved.
I want to hear the story about how it came apart. And I'm making notes. I want to hear the story. But one of the things that I wrote down is I just wrote down two words, which is deficiency and hierarchy. Like sort of this assumption of like, oh, like I got to keep working at this. I got to get more spiritual. I got to give more, which sort of, if you start to peel that apart, there's a story of deficiency, right? Like not enoughness or something. Like why?
Definitely.
Why do we have to get
better?
And the other thing is like that progressive language. Like there's a hierarchy of spiritual, I don't know, goodness or a place of arrival that demonstrates your goodness. We can either talk about that now. I just kind of wanted to throw that out. And I also want to hear your story.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Well, I think the best way for me to talk about how the house of cards all began to fall was by entering into seminary. I decided to go to seminary when right before I turned 40. My girls were probably, what would they have been, like 4 and 6? They were super young, still married to the pastor, you know, still sitting in the front row at church every single Sunday. And I didn't go to seminary because I wanted to be a pastor. One in our house was more than enough. But because the school that I chose was very liberal, very provocative, really thinking about faith and belief through the lens of what's applicable to culture. How do we think about our beliefs and our faith in a world that does or does not understand it? What does it mean today? And I was super intrigued by that. Anyway, while I was there, a number of things happened. I took a ton of classes, obviously, learned a lot of things that I already knew over again, but through an academic lens. But two things in particular occurred that really changed everything. One was that I took a class called Feminist Critique. It was the only time the class had ever been offered, and it's never been offered since, even though I've continued to advocate for its presence ongoing. That was 20 years ago now when I
took
the class.
I don't know why I'm giggling. I'm just, you know, imagining Feminist Critique, you know, blowing up all kinds of stuff there. But
yeah,
yes.
It definitely did for me, for sure. And though it's slightly embarrassing for me to say it, but it is my story. Like I really had not had a lot of exposure to feminism, certainly not feminist theology, certainly not a really personal awareness of the objectification of women. Not just spiritually or in sacred contexts, but globally. Like I just had not seen it. And then I couldn't not see it. It was hugely significant for me to start recognizing this and then to begin to start to put some pieces together as it related to my own religious upbringing and began this process of me really starting to question so much. The second thing that was happening was that I was taking both Hebrew and Greek, the original languages of the Old and New Testament. And in Hebrew specifically, the class was almost all men. There were two of us, two women in the class, and we were translating the book of Ruth over the course of this class. And every day we would come in with the passage translated. And what I started to recognize over time was that this other woman and myself were translating the text just a slight bit differently than the men. The story wasn't changing. The subjects, the verbs, the nouns, all of those were the same. But there was this tone that was different. And the men in the class would consistently say, "That's not right. You can't translate it that way." And the two of us would say, "Well, we followed all the grammatical rules. Like everything that you did, we did. It's just not the same." And what I started to realize was, oh, the text changes when it's told through a woman's lens. It's not the same because, of course, all of scripture is subjective. All of it's been told through the lens of the storyteller themselves. And why wouldn't that happen when women tell the story through their own lens? So, of course, you know, to talk about a house of cards. Once I saw this, then I'm like, wait a second. None of these stories have been told through a women's lens. Not really. I mean, yes, there are feminist theologians and scholars over the years who have tried to make this case, but not mainstreamed. I'm like, that's not okay with me. That's got to change. What would happen if? And so as my final project, while I was still at seminary, I started experimenting with this. And I took one story and from an academic standpoint, kind of deconstructed all of the ways that it had been told and reinvited a different way of looking at it through a woman's perspective. And all of those things combined over time were really, and then of course, leaving my marriage and leaving the church and, you know, just one thing after another, it just completely changed how I saw everything that I had just taken for granted and assumed to be true and turned it upside down and allowed me to start asking some questions and not accepting the answers I'd heard previously and creating a new and different way of understanding what it means to be a woman who also has a sense of the sacred.
Yes. Oh my gosh. That resonates with me so much, Rana. And I know you know that. We had a lovely conversation a while back before we did this podcast. And it is amazing, right? Because you can apply that, what you learned there, to our whole culture, right? I mean, even, you know, I studied journalism in college, and I think I loved the idea of objectivity. Like, I just love that, you know, it's so comforting. Like there's something like the ground underneath your feet, right? Of like, oh, but this is the answer. Like, this is the answer. And yet you realize this, everything is subjective to a certain, like we cannot strip ourselves from the experience. And then when you realize, okay, but what does that mean if a small group of individuals have been controlling the narrative? Like, what are we missing? Oh, it's really revolutionary. Right. And then you look at, and then you look at the historical aspect of that too. And like, oh wait, we've normalized this for thousands of years. So we're talking like the impacts just go on and on and on. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. There's no end, no end, which is what I think is so important to always be talking about so that we can see and name that for ourselves.
Well, and I want to ask you about, because from where I'm sitting now, you're looking pretty great. Like, you've got this book coming out, but I want to talk about that sort of disillusion and breakdown part for just a minute, if you're okay with that.
Sure.
Because I think we like to, culturally, we like the comeback story, right? Like, here I am on the other side and everything's bright and shiny and great. But if you're comfortable with that, could you talk about what that was like for you in your life at the time? I would imagine it was pretty disorienting.
Yeah, it's very disorienting. I think even for people who didn't grow up in the church the way that I did, to have the primary stories or way of seeing the world turned upside down and backwards is always discombobulating and disconcerting. And for me, probably the place where this showed up the most painfully, but also the most redemptively, I think, over time, was in the context of my marriage. I remember, you know, as I progressively got clearer on the things that weren't working, where the problems were, what had caused them, all of that, in the back of my mind, and sometimes right at the tip of my tongue, was this belief that I couldn't divorce. Like, surely God would want my marriage to survive. Surely I've made a covenant. Like, this is what God would most want. I need to persevere and be more patient, and I have to work on me. Like, what do I need to do differently in order to make this work? Because anything else felt like I was failing and not faithful enough, not trusting enough. And I remember laying in bed one morning, and it was super early. I couldn't get back to sleep. I still married. And I remember hearing this question kind of circling around in my mind. Is God's relationship with you, Rana, now hooked to your relationship to your husband? Like, once you got married, did you no longer have a relationship with God that was just you? And I thought, no, of course, that's ridiculous. No, I don't believe that. And then the next question that came to my mind was, well, if that's the case, if God still has a relationship with you, then wouldn't God want you to feel whole and fulfilled and authentic and yourself? And I'm like, oh, wait, yeah, I guess that would be true. And I mean, literally, I can remember this even in the moment now, as I'm thinking about it now. Like, it was so confusing to me to consider that I could trust what I heard, that I could make a choice on my own behalf, that I could listen to some kind of intuitive wisdom that could still potentially be aligned with the beliefs that I held at the time. I don't anymore, but I did at the time. That it was both this amazing experience, of which I had many over time, but also completely upsetting. Now I have to figure out how to have a conversation, not only with myself, but with my husband, with my parents, with my daughters, about why it's okay for me to make this choice, that I'm not sinning somehow, that I'm not failing, that I'm not being spiritual. And I mean, I could just tell you so many stories about that rending, those places of massive conflict for me, that over time became less difficult because I moved more to the side of trusting myself and listening to my own wisdom and voice. But wow, in those early days, it just felt like, it felt impossible. It felt completely dissonant. It felt disobedient. It felt shocking. And, you know, as I have time, as I have conversations with women all the time, with my clients, you know, I hear this again and again, like, well, I can't, well, I shouldn't, well, it wouldn't be okay if I, as though we've set aside our own agency and sovereignty and thinking on behalf of some doctrine that now holds the ultimate say. That's a hard place to be. It's really hard to get over that. And we look back at it, like I look back at it now and I go, that's ridiculous. Like, just make up your own mind. Just decide for yourself. You get, you know, but wow, when you're in a world that has taught you that your voice is always under men's first, but God's for sure.
Yeah.
It's really hard to break through that without feeling selfish or feeling any myriad of emotions. It was very difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. I can feel that. And it seems like moving through it can be really liberating too, right? And getting on the other side.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm curious too for you then, you know, especially in the context of what you just shared, did you leave the church at this time as well? Or was it all just like everything was like, boom, coming down? Or did that take more time? Like, what was that process like?
Well, I think it was a pretty easy decision to leave the church when I had been married to the pastor of the church.
Yeah, okay.
I clearly wasn't going back there.
Good point.
And I did probably spend a couple of months after we separated, you know, in the midst between the separation and the divorce, going other places, trying them out. But I will tell you, you know, having been in the church my whole life and then having been a pastor's wife, it's super difficult to not be critiquing everything that's not going the way that you think it should. It's sort of like being a producer and watching a play or a film that isn't your own, where you're like, that should have been done this way. Why didn't you do this? Like, it was really hard for me just to sit there and not have a place to have an opinion or to be leading or but I think the other thing that happened that was really significant for me in that regard was I found a church with a woman pastor. I looked for this intentionally. I decided I was done with seminary by now. I thought, you know what? I'm just going to go find a church where there's a woman, because for sure that will be better. Mm. And I'd gone a couple of times and it was okay. But there was one particular Sunday where she preached a sermon, told a story from the text about a woman. And I was so mad. I wish I could remember what the story was, but I completely disagreed with what she said. And more, I was shocked by the fact that at no point in time did she acknowledge the woman's take on the story, the woman's perspective of what was happening. It was just this standard, traditional, patriarchal, misogynistic telling of this story. So service is over. She's standing in the narthex area, right? Shaking everybody's hand. And she said, "Rana, so glad you came back." And I said, "Yeah, I would love to get a cup of coffee and sit down and talk with you about how you chose to tell that story today." And she goes, "Oh, did you love it?" And I said, "Well, I love the story, but I don't like the way you told it. Like, I think you missed what was so important to be told there." And I could see that she was very gracious, but super flustered by this. And I said, "Seriously, like, email or call me. Like, I would really love to have this conversation with you." She never did. And I remember thinking, how is that possible? Like, I tried to put myself in her position and I thought, I would have called just because I would have been curious. Like, I just would have wanted to know, even if it hurt my feelings, I would want to know. Never heard from her. And I thought, okay, I'm not going to find what I want. I'm not going to find what I'm looking for. I'm not going to hear what I think is honest and true and needs to be said. So it was not a hard place for me to walk away. And as you said in my bio, like, I walked away from the church and from religion, but something in me just couldn't leave those women behind. I just felt like they've been harmed enough and they've been ignored enough. They've not been heard enough. And for me to leave, but not take them with me, feels like doubling down on the harm that I've experienced and that they've experienced. Is there a way that I could walk away from the doctrine and the dogma, keep the stories of the women with me, and retell them without the doctrine and the dogma? Would that be possible? Is there a world in which those stories could be heard without us, like, you know, the slippery slope of feeling like we're back in church listening to stuff we don't want to hear? And that remains my ongoing question and pursuit, to be sure. But in many ways, I just, you know, I say that I couldn't leave them, but in many ways, I feel like they refused to let me leave. Mm-hmm. Like, they said, "Oh, no, we're going to take you where we want you to go. And so come on, let's go tell these stories a different way."
Wow. I so appreciate that reflection. I know, as for myself, as a recovering Christian, I don't consider myself mm-hmm. Christian anymore. Yeah. I think, well, that's probably obvious to everyone who listens to this podcast, stating the obvious, but I know that I've definitely, there's a way in which we can look back at the patriarchal BS that we've gotten. Okay. There's a way I can look back at the patriarchal BS that I've gotten and be like, I'm just going to burn this all down. I don't want anything to do mm-hmm. with any of it. Just get out mm-hmm. of my view. And yeah, I just sure. so appreciate your reflection about not leaving the women behind, that they've been harmed enough. Like, I really felt that resonate in my body mm-hmm. when you said that. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want to know, and then I want to get into some of these stories of the women, because that's what your book is about. But I want to ask you, and maybe these questions sort of go together. I don't know. We can break them apart if we need to. But I always love to hear from people, like, who or what the sacred feminine is to you in this moment. And if you want to use different language around that, that is totally fine. And mm-hmm. if this question is related or not, you can tell me. But I'm wondering where you found your spiritual ground, like where you landed after mm-hmm. you left, you took the women with you, but like, how'd you find your mm-hmm. footing?
Yeah. Okay. I think how I would describe the sacred feminine has shifted and changed over time from the first time I ever encountered it to how I might think about it now. And I think because I'm so hesitant's not the right word. I'm so determined to understand the divine as something within versus an entity outside of me, that I think about it now more as the deeply intuitive and powerful wisdom that has always been mine, that belongs to all of us as women. I mean, the phrasing I use all the time in my writing is that know that you know that you know voice within. Like, it's what I was talking about even in the context of leaving my marriage. Like, can I actually listen to what is within me that is so wise? But I don't hear it as wise initially, right? It takes so much time to begin to trust that voice. And so that voice, that wisdom, that sense of knowing within is how I would describe the sacred feminine. And I think we can see its manifestation collectively when women have conversations together, when women are in community together, and we see and honor each other's wisdom, then it's like all around us. It's everywhere. It's palpable and tangible and in our midst, but ours individually and uniquely to claim.
Mm-hmm.
What was the second part? Oh, how, where have I come?
Yeah. And as your spiritual grounding, well, you just go ahead. Yeah. I don't think I need to say anything.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, I think that's an open-ended question for me. I am really clear about and committed to the presence of, the experience of, and expression of the sacred, which can be found in any myriad of ways, obviously, like in nature, in emotion, in looking through a photo album, you know, like there's so many ways in which I think we experience the sacred. I think it is everything and all around us and within us all the time. So it's probably the word I use more than spirituality or my own sense of what it means to be spiritual. I think it's just an ongoing kind of question and exploration for me. I don't think that I've moved from one set of beliefs to another one. And I've been pretty intentional about not doing that because it's felt like it's just the same thing with a different name in a lot of ways. And I don't want to replace it. I want something that feels generative and curious and imaginative and almost uncapturable, that I can continue to lean toward and wonder about. And so I do. And in my writing is where most of that shows up for me, my own exploration for sure.
Well, that makes so much sense to me too, with what you're saying about sourcing the sacred feminine, like that being inside. And I was just thinking that if we really understand the sacred as living inside of ourselves and then inside of everything around us, then what need do we have for dogma? Right? Exactly. Like, I mean, but you don't need to codify anything. And so, you know, it's all, it's just, you're just going to find it. It's everywhere. Yep.
That's exactly right.
And how liberating. And I guess that takes me back to, you know, dogma as a way of like control, you know, like, and whether or not it started or that was the intention, it becomes that, right? Because you lose
for sure
the access to your own, just like the story you're telling about with your marriage ending, like you're like, how can I possibly trust myself? Which if we think about it is an insane thought. How could we not trust ourselves? Right. But yeah.
Well, and I know why we no longer trust ourselves. Like in my thinking, in my body of thought, right, as I consider all of this, I mean, I just go right back to the story of Eve. This is why we don't trust ourselves. And it, you know, because of the way her story was told, not because of the story itself, but because of the way it's been told throughout time, the way that it's been interpreted, the way that it has been manipulated, the way that it has been utilized in order to silence and shame women. Now, nobody set out to silence and shame women necessarily, though one might wonder. I mean, we have to figure out where to put our finger down on this whole timeline. But
it's tricky, right? Because you don't want to give anybody credit for being like a mastermind that's like, wahaha, I figured it out. And yet.
Exactly. And yet it does appear that that is over time, certainly what happened.
Yeah.
But my point in that is that, of course, like, again, whether you ever darkened the door of a church or not, your everyday life, at least in the Western world, is profoundly influenced by the story of Eve. I would say our social policy, wages, certainly Roe v. Wade and its overturning. I mean, like, it doesn't, you can get any example that we want to look at. I would say, yep, that would be Eve. Yep, that would be the story of Eve. Now, of course, there's been all kinds of things that have flowed from that, but in my worldview, that's the source. That's where it started. And so, I mean, one of the things I talk about in the book is, you know, when you begin to recognize just how much power that woman's story has had, the way it's been told, not the story itself, but the way it's been told, how much power has been inherent in one woman's story and the way it's been told, then I think, well, then couldn't the same be true again? Couldn't one woman's story retold have just as much power? Look at how much influence not Eve herself has had, but the way her story's been told. What if Eve's story retold could do exactly the same thing, but in exactly the opposite way? Undo all of the harm, all of the pain, all of the silencing, all of the shame, an entire world of social policy that continues to oppress and marginalize. I mean, the whole world would be different. And I would hope that it still could be.
Okay. I want to dive into that more. And I want to hear you, because I know this is your TED Talk is about Eve before you even got to writing the book. And I want also for any listeners who are not as steeped in Christianity as Rana and I are, I'd love for you to kind of help me catch them up a little bit on that's like, if they're like, I don't know what you're talking about. How can Eve relate to all this? But one of the things that I wrote down, and I didn't write down who you were quoting somebody from your book, but I love this so much, is, and now I'm going to jump ahead for people who don't know the Eve story, but you quoted somebody who said, it takes courage to kiss a snake and a soulful audacity to sink one's teeth into the forbidden fruit. And I was just like, hell yes, it does. Like, that's a totally different way to look at it. Like, how gutsy is that move, you know, to be like, ah, yes, I am called to this. I'm going to do it anyway. I just loved that. And I think that for me, it just encapsulates why it's so important to have somebody besides a handful of white men,
you know, and whatever, I think, Liz,
interpreting this.
Yeah. And I think, you know, oftentimes when we look at Eve's story, like, we can pull forth sort of the dangerous, risky, brave aspects of what she did, which is often in juxtaposition or in conflict, however we want to say that, dissonance with the predominant way the story's been told. I also think that there are ways to look at that story that don't have to be dissonant, but that we've just missed. So for an example of this would be that really the first time in the entire text of Christian scripture, Jewish and Christian scripture, that any comprehension of the divine is named, it's a woman who expresses that, not Adam, it's Eve. The serpent says to her, did God tell you that you couldn't eat from any fruit from any of the trees? And she says, no, that's not. And she speaks about her understanding of the divine. So I look at that and I think, how come no one told me that the very first theological expression was a woman? Why has that not been talked about? So it's not, again, not just she, you know, kissed the snake, ate the fruit, defied power. Like, it's not just that. It's also that there are so many things in that story that we just haven't looked at, that we've just not considered, that have just, you know, faded into oblivion or were never talked about at all. And that's just Eve's story. Good God, I can just keep going for forever when I start looking at additional stories within the text. And I keep thinking and saying and writing that what would be different in our lives today as women if we'd heard a story of a woman like that?
Yeah.
If we'd heard about a story of a woman from our childhood and had permeated our culture in which women trusted their own wisdom, in which women understood that they could themselves talk about how they understood the divine, that women could make choices, and that all hell doesn't break loose, the world doesn't come to an end, but instead, great expanse opens up, new worlds are created. Relationship, in fact, this is the other thing I talk about in her story. We think that when Eve and Adam left the garden, that they were banished because of Eve's sin, right? And Adam follows right along and God says, out of here, like you're banished. No, in truth, the intimacy and care and intention that the divine offers and exhibits begins when they leave the garden. And then we have an entire story that goes on for generation after generation after generation of a God who steps in, intimately cares for humanity. Not one who says, you're not good enough, get out. It's exactly the opposite. And yet that's not how we tell the story. We say that because of what Eve did, you know, we've been cast into the pit of hell for forever. Mm. And I'm like, no, it was exactly the opposite. Exactly the opposite. Hmm. So this whole idea of getting back to Eden, like we hear this in Christian language, like a return to Eden, getting back to when things were perfect, getting back to when we still walked in the garden in the cool of the day with God. I'm like, oh no, 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 no. That all happened after.
Hmm.
That all happened after. Mm-hmm. Because she made a choice. Yay her.
I so appreciate that reframe on many levels. I'm going to just say quickly, for those of you, I don't know if there's anybody listening that doesn't know the story of Adam and Eve, you know, first man, first woman in Christian mythology, yeah. I guess. And you know, Eve is tempted by a snake who gets her to eat fruit that God supposedly told her not to. And when that happens, God gets mad, kicks him out of the garden. There's your catch up. Google it. And if you're confused, like there's more. But I, you know what also came to mind when you're saying that is, boy, everything could be sort of reframed. Like one of the things, the outcomes that God in the, you know, in the Gideon Bible that my granddad gave me, it says, you know, that one of the outcomes is that Eve is going to have to suffer the pains of childbirth.
Right.
Which is such a man's way of interpreting like the joy of having a child. Like, I don't know. But there's even a there's a missing of a teaching there about sometimes our deepest and most spiritual, our closest moments to the divine come from these moments of pain that crack us wide open. Mm-hmm. So that's not necessarily punishment. And then of course, what you get out of that is new life. I mean, come on, doesn't get any better than that. I do it 50 times over to get my kids, you know, so.
Exactly. Yeah. I love that, Liz. I think that's so powerful. And I think that's one of the things that I continue to appreciate and love and reinforce in these women's stories is that many of them are excruciating, which is why we don't like them, frankly.
Yeah.
That's part of the reason that we don't like them. And I think so is my life. So is the lives of people around us. So is what we see happening in the world on a day-to-day basis. I don't want stories that end with happily ever after, that are neatly tied up with a bow. Like that is, I can't relate to that. I need stories of women who know what pain feels like, who understand betrayal, who are familiar with harm and oh my gosh, the list is so long, because that's my story. Mm-hmm. That's all of our stories. Yeah. And if I can be companioned and mentored and guided by women who know and understand my pain, my hurt, my disappointments, my failings, thank you. That those are the women I have as friends, and those are the women that I would want as spiritual or sacred guides in my life.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I wonder too, if you could connect the dots for listeners and for me, and we can just use one example, like you were referencing, like, Roe v. Wade and different, you know, like that being overturned mm-hmm. and stuff. Like, can you connect the dots for us of like how you see Eve's story relating to some of the, any of one of those that you mentioned, you know, some of the cultural context that we live in now?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's a whole historical lineage of the ways in which those earliest interpretations of her story made their way into philosophical systems, Aristotle or, you know, any of these early thinkers. We see their take and their understanding on the story. And what we know historically is that, you know, church and state weren't separate many, many years ago. Like, religious thought was what shaped politics, was what shaped philosophy. And even if you only think about the history of the United States, it was a group of people who wanted to leave British rule and worship the way they wanted to work. It was religiously motivated.
Yeah.
If we read the Declaration of Independence, we read any of these early documents, they were faith-based. So that's why I say, particularly in the Western world, you can't pull these stories, this scriptural foundation, out of what has shaped our entire world. So in specific, like if we just look at the role of women in the home in the 50s, for example, well, what was the standard? Women stayed home. Women didn't work. Women understood that their role was to take care of their kids. Their role was to be submissive. Their role was to be obedient. And this had nothing to do with whether you went to church. Now, if you did go to church, you heard all of this in church. But even if you didn't, the predominant cultural motif in the 50s, and certainly we could go back way further than that, but let's just go to a time period that we have some memory of. Women didn't have voice. If a woman would have spoken up at that time, she would have been shamed. She would have been silenced. She would have been seen as too much. We move this forward into the workforce, where women still today make less than men. Why? Well, because that's just how it's always been. Well, because, you know, if we give women too much power, who knows what they'll do? Well, because that's, you know, men are more powerful, men are stronger, men are better communicators, men, like, you know, all stupid ridiculousness. But, you know, it's what we've said. We don't agree with it now, but it certainly would have been standard protocol, assumed and believed things. When we look at social policies like childcare or the lack thereof, when we look at, and then to use my example of Roe v. Wade, like, I don't know how else to explain the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade other than a deep-seated fear of women having any agency, choice, or will. Now, where does that come from? Why would the Supreme Court, politics in general, you know, large swaths of the way people think, be such a thing? Because it's all we've ever heard from the beginning of time in the Judeo-Christian tradition. So I'm waxing and waning and, you know, wandering around here, but it's just insipid. It's just everywhere.
Yeah. And I think it's all super valid. And I think, I know when I've done my own research and, you know, we are dancing around the same topic and coming at it in different ways, perhaps. But I definitely feel like I've encountered people who are like, well, if they're not religious, then this doesn't matter to me, right? Like, how does this relate to me? And to your point, it is the underpinning of so many of our structures. It is the, it's right there. And so it doesn't matter what your belief structure is or not. It's the water you're swimming in. We're all swimming in it. So we've all, if you're here in the United States, you're getting that. The other thing I wanted to say that came to me as you were talking is, I got back not too long ago from the Parliament of the World's Religions in Chicago. It was an amazing experience. I hope to have a future episode at some point. I was presenting with some other women there on the topic of how we foster intersectionality in earth-based spiritual traditions. And I want to have my panelists on so we can give you all a taste of that conversation. But one of the things that I noticed, there's 7,000 people that attended this thing over, a week. In the opening ceremony, well, first of all the magic seemed to happen. Like, it was very magical for me, but all of it happened outside of the officially organized structures. It was like in the
as it should be. That's
right?
Awesome. Yeah.
But in the opening session, it took, and we were an hour and a half in before a woman took the stage, an hour and a half in. And there's just no excuse for it. I've talked to many women who are involved and have been involved with the parliament for a long time. There's been feedback that's been given for decades. And the woman that finally did take the stage was a pagan priestess who was singing a song to Tonantzin, who is, the indigenous Mexican goddess that Guadalupe is based on. And you could feel, I could feel that just, it was like an audible shift of energy in this massive stadium where people were uncomfortable. People were uncomfortable. I think it would have been different. I know, right? But it was also, it made me angry on her behalf. Yeah. I'm like, you could feel people's attention kind of waning. And I don't know if it would have been different. It might have been a little different if she was getting up and officially sanctioning a patriarchal religion. You know what I mean? If she had on the clergy collar and she's advocating for Christianity or whatever. Yeah. But it was so striking to me that in this event, which is supposed to be about plurality and all of us coming together, it's that undercurrent is still there. It's so present and it's so effing frustrating, really.
Yeah. And I think what it speaks to is something that you mentioned earlier. Given that, given just how toxic this patriarchal religion has been and is, why not throw the whole damn thing out? Like, let's walk away from all of it, right? Like, let's definitely throw the baby out with the bathwater on this one, because there's nothing in there that is worth that. And I get that. There have been many, many times, certainly as I've been writing the book, which has taken me almost 20 years, where I thought, this is ridiculous. I just need to put this all away and start to focus on something else, because it's so awful. It's so much work to climb out of this and still find any redeeming value in these stories. But what I keep coming back to is that there's a difference between the stories and the doctrine, between the stories and what we've done with them. And so I look at stories like Isis or Medusa or Persephone, and I think, we're not going to let those stories go. We don't look at those stories and go, forget it. Like, let's just not even tell those anymore. Instead, we mine them for the wisdom that is present. We see the themes of those stories all over the place. We can find the threads if we look for them very closely, at them very closely. And I think the same is true with stories like Harriet Tubman or the women who it was that movie Hidden Figures, the women at NASA who, did all the mathematical equations that allowed the Apollo mission to succeed, like all those things. Like, those stories of women, we would never deny, we would never abolish, we would never burn, we wouldn't do that because we see their lasting significance and import. And I think that's what keeps me coming back to these stories, despite the fact that I don't like the text that they're in. I don't like all of the things that have happened to them. I don't like the fact that they're disregarded and dismissed and completely misinterpreted. I don't like any of that. But yeah, they're stories of women that deserve to be told, just like ours.
I love that perspective. And I wonder if you could share, I mean, your whole book is full of these, you know, wonderful stories, some that I knew and some that I didn't know, but I wonder if you'd be willing to share one perhaps, or just, you know, maybe one that our listeners wouldn't know about all that well, or one that would make them go, oh, I never thought about it that way, that really, or that really spoke to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sure. So, okay. The story I was thinking about, earlier this morning in the think with the possibility that you would ask me this question, I can always go to Eve, which of course I've already talked about. The story I most of the time go to is the story of Hagar, because she's probably my favorite for very, very personal reasons. But the story I was thinking about this morning was the story of Queen Vashti. Most of us, especially those of us who grew up in the church, know the story of Esther, Queen Esther. Her story is preceded and only made possible because of the story of Queen Vashti. So the way that this story goes is that there King Xerxes throws this lavish party for all of the men of his kingdom. And it goes on for months. And the text describes, you know, the golden bowls, the ruby encrusted goblets, the wine that flowed endlessly, et cetera. And after days and days and days and days of this party, the king calls for his queen, Vashti, to come before all of the men of his kingdom. Now, some have said over time that the king wanted her to parade about naked. There's nothing in the text that tells us that. We don't know whether that was the case or not. But the fact is that she was his possession, and he wants to show off. He already has been for days and days, but let's bring her up.
Yeah.
So she gets the message that she's supposed to come, and she says no. Now, I think it's significant to recognize that all these men who've been partying for weeks, if not months on end, brought women with them, their wives, their mistresses, their consorts, all of them, excuse me, would have been staying in separate lodging where the queen would have been. So when she says no, it's not this isolated two-letter word that only the king and everyone, all the men hear. The women hear this as well. She says no. The message goes back to the king. He's furious, and he calls all of his advisors together, and because he can't make up his mind for himself, obviously, and he says, what should I do? And the advisors basically say, well, you know, you have to banish her, because if you don't, all the women in the kingdom and for miles on end will get the idea that they could do the same thing. So he banishes Vashti. And that's all we ever hear of her. That's the end of her story. And then Esther's picks up from right there, because of course he couldn't possibly live without a queen. So he has to find a new one. And so sex traffics her right in. But that's another story. So anyway, this story of Vashti is told about the way that I told it, but not nearly as pejorative toward the king. Instead, it's told sometimes in the best of ways. It's said, you know, of course he shouldn't have wanted to parade her before the men. That was disrespectful of her. But that's not most of the time what we hear. What we get out of that story is how dangerous it is when a woman says no, and totally not okay, which is why we don't hear that story very often. Which is why it's not told very often, because that, in fact, is what she does. And so, again, I think to what I said to you just a few minutes ago, imagine if as a little girl, I had grown up hearing the story of Vashti praised. I had grown up hearing about a woman who is asked to compromise herself, who is asked to only be valued for her beauty and her sexuality and her physical presence. And she says, no. If I had grown up understanding that I was able to say no, that in the face of power, it was legitimate for me to refuse it, no matter what it cost me, which it costs her everything. She loses everything. But she couldn't not make that choice. So think about how many places we find ourselves in a lifetime in which we compromise because the cost feels too great.
Yeah,
I compromise my voice, my preferences, my desires, my opinions, because it's going to cost me my marriage. I compromise how I show up in my job on a day-to-day basis, because if I were to speak up and say what I really think, my boss is going to be pissed and it's going to cause all kinds of problems. And it's easier for me to just not say what I think in the meeting. If I say no to social media influencers and this constant pressure to be thinner, look better, buy more, shop, spend, all that, it costs me because I'm not in the flow of what everybody else seems to be talking about and doing. I'm on the outside. I'm marginalized. That's because many reasons, but in part because I didn't get to hear the story of a woman who said, no compromise is worth it to me. I will not comply. I will let go of everything in order to hold on to what matters most. So, you know, in the book, I tell other stories that relate to her that I just, and honestly, I was looking at it this morning. While I was writing her story is when the first rumors of Roe v. Wade being overturned came out. And I thought, of course, because when a woman says no, we don't have a category for, I mean, we personally might, but societally, historically, there's women don't get to choose. Nope. We're not going to allow that. And I just thought it's Vashti's story all over again, but not redemptively, not in a way that allows us to find our voices and have them heard in ways that reverberate through the kingdom, through, you know, for miles and miles on end, that have women, or excuse me, that then have men of power getting together going, what should we do? What should we do? This isn't okay. It's not okay. It's not okay.
Wow.
Which is why these, to me, the story of her story matters. Like when I find myself in places of my own compromise and compliance, and I have plenty of those stories, I think, okay, what do I know about Vashti? How did she have the courage and the ability and the foresight and the wisdom to understand why no was the right answer? How was she willing to risk everything? And I think one of the reasons, when I look at the bigger story, is because she had to have known later that her no was what enabled Esther's story to take place, which is phenomenal. I mean, it's hard and difficult, but we have a next generation of a woman who had to have been influenced by Vashti's example. And that to me feels like it was probably worth the cost. And generationally, if we keep up with the story, right? Like,
yeah,
you know, we just think about generation after generation after generation of women who have been influenced, or said differently, if we had been influenced by those stories told that way, we would not live in the world we do today.
Mm-hmm.
So let's change it by telling the stories a different way.
Yeah. I'm thinking of so many So many things there too. Well, Joan of Arc actually popped to mind when you were talking about, you know, there's a woman who had a very sacred no, and we don't talk about how powerful and strong her, I mean, I know the church apologized, whatever, but I mean, they still murdered her, you know, like she liberated France and they still murdered her. I mean, it's wild. Because she said, no, she wasn't going to compromise on her vision. And if we just, I was just imagining lining those stories up side by side of a woman's sacred no.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in service to something that she knows is right.
Yes.
And that the men on the other side know is right too.
Yeah.
And, you know, just that example of like, this is what it looks like. And this is how it's been suppressed. Like,
And in many ways, now that you're, and in many ways, as you're saying this, what I'm thinking about is Eve gives us the example of what a sacred yes looks like when we redeem the story, not when we tell it as it's been told, right? Because then what we would hear is when a woman says yes, all hell breaks loose. No, a sacred yes looks like Eve's story reimagined and redeemed. Yeah. A sacred no looks like Vashti's story held up as this beautiful moment in time of what it means to not compromise, to not comply, to be sovereign. We need those.
Oh my God, we do. Like this, you could not have put like a better bow on this episode than just right there. So well done. Oh my gosh, this is so good. I could talk to you for forever. But I feel like that's such a good place to stop. And I want to say to you all who are listening, like, what is your sacred yes? And what is your sacred no? Like, what great, great questions to consider. And what would the world look like if we just honored those things?
And how might you make both of those yeses and nos, knowing that you're not alone?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right. And for me, that's been the deepest gift and privilege of walking with these stories, is being reminded again and again and again, I'm not alone in this. I'm not alone when I say yes and people think I'm too much. I'm not alone when I say no and people aren't happy about it. I'm accompanied and companioned by this whole host of women who walk alongside.
Yeah. And they're here too, you know. Let's find each other, shall we? We're out there. I just had a beautiful vision of Vashti walking out and the other women being like, well, fuck this, let's go too. And they all find each other. And instead of being banished, like, what are we going to build?
Exactly.
What are we going to build together?
Exactly. Yes, for sure.
My gosh. Rana, thank you so much. Rana's book, Rewriting Eve, Claiming Women's Sacred Stories, is our own. I'm holding it up if you're watching this. Oh, I made weird noises with my keyboard there, but check it out for sure. I'll put it in the show notes. And Rana, thank you so much. What a joy to be in conversation with you. My heart feels very full. Thank you.
Mine too. Thank you, Liz. I so appreciate it.
And thanks to all of you for listening. As always, if you like this show, you can tell other people about it. You can subscribe. You can leave it a favorable review. Yeah, that's the third thing. You can do all those things if you so desire. And until next time, take very good care of yourself, and I will talk to you again very soon. Home to Her is hosted by me, Liz Kelly. You can visit me online at hometoher.com, where you can find show notes and other episodes. You can read articles about the sacred feminine, and you'll also find a link to join the Home to Her Facebook group for lots more discussion and exploration of her. You can also follow me on Instagram at Home to Her to keep up to date with the latest episodes. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you back here soon.